Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Totally football show, totally at the World Cup.
They're creating a singularity that will consume the planet.
How long does the planet have?
Minutes.
Unbelievable, unbelievable this.
Day 6, easy peasy, Japanese, as Samurai Blue give Colombia mighty blows, something Colombians will know all about. Meanwhile, stereotypes ahoy as Polish go plumbing the depths with Senegal. And Tuesday evening, home nation believing in Chechnyazov as Russians all but put their place in the last 16. Wednesday, we'll see Uruguay have a go at Saudi Arabia, then Group B is back, Portugal against Morocco. And what are Iran's prospects against Spain? We'll get the view from Toronto. It's all in Totally Football Show at the World Cup. And here we are, everybody, with your panel today. Michael Cox is here.
Hello, James.
We've got Duncan Alexander.
Hi, James.
Welcome, Duncan. And Sasha Gurianov.
Dobry večer, James.
Yeah. Sasha, it's so good to have you here. We've just seen Russia victorious once again. There's wrong, and then there's your pre-World Cup predictions about the team you described as the worst in Russian history. What have you got to say for yourself?
I'd say that I'm delighted to be so spectacularly wrong, and I think most of Russian journalists too. I'm still trying to calm down after watching that, but another really clinical and very professional performance from the Russians, which it, for me, again, is completely and utterly unexpected. Mm-hmm. I know that after Saudi Arabia, it was very tempting to write it off because Saudi Arabia was so bad. But today, against Egypt, who really had to win this game, Russians actually were very, very efficient. Mm. And they managed to control, I think, the first half reasonably well. The last 15 minutes before halftime were a little bit more scary. But the way they came out for the second half, established a 3-goal lead, and then pretty much saw out the game, even though I have to admit I got massively nervous when Salah pulled back the penalty. But those last 20 minutes, Russia weren't really in trouble at all.
Yeah, they were regarded as kind of the football underclass, but they've completely overturned the social order and entered a whole new paradigm.
They also overturned 3 decades of almost abject failure in the face of a lot of scepticism at home. And I think this team was under a lot of pressure before the first game, the pressure that was lifted by that great result. And today, you know, to see Russian players smiling when they're playing football, like Zubov was, like Samedov was in those closing minutes, really, really enjoying themselves, it's absolutely great.
Duncan, I need a stat to help me process what's going on here.
Yeah, I think to put it into context, Russia have now scored as many goals in 2 games at this World Cup as Spain did in 2010 in the entire tournament, when they won the tournament.
So when Spain were world champions, tiki-tastic Spain in 2010, this Russia have scored as many goals as that?
They have, and they've equaled the most by host nation in their first 2 games with Italy in 1934. So it's pretty unprecedented, really. I mean, it's surprising, but when you look a bit deeper, it's really, really surprising.
Well, 3 goals this evening. The first, a fatty own goal, the shot from Sasha?
From Zobnin, one of the two sort of more defensive midfielders. But again, it's the Dzyuba factor. I said before today that I probably would have rather gone safer with Smolov, but this is what Dzyuba does. It's just a big unit up front who puts himself about.
You called him a tree.
He is a tree. but he's a tree that can be extremely efficient. And
right.
As we saw today, I think the first fatty mistake is the fact that basically Dzyuba is all over him,
right,
just putting him off, well, literally off balance. And the way Dzyuba took the third on his chest is big, classic centre-forward play. Again, the celebrations, he's a guy who is very outspoken. With him, basically, you know, he doesn't act. He's just himself all the time.
Juba.
And he is, I think this the sort of joy with which he plays football, I think the joy, the way he grabbed his chance with both hands, because he wasn't the starting centre-forward before the tournament. I have to give him a lot of credit for it, because also I think there were sort of frictions with the manager as well. Historically, you know, he wasn't... there was a while where he was out of the team because him and Cherchesov just didn't get on. And the fact that he, with his big ego and his big personality, managed to sort of work his way back in. You know, he's more perhaps more of a diplomat than people give him credit for.
And World Cups historically have been, you know, there's been quite a few examples of strikers coming in, you know, not being first choice, but becoming that during the tournament. You think back to Jeff Hurst in 66.
Toto Skelacci.
So maybe, you know, he's the 2018 version.
Perhaps so. All right. And the middle goal... Another from the very lovely Cherchesov. What's special about him, Sasha?
He is not in the Panini sticker album, I believe, which puts him alongside the great Igor Belanov in 1986, the who won the Golden Ball that year, by the way, who went on to score 4 World Cup goals in the 86 World Cup.
Incredible. Michael, what do you think? Sasha has already caved in and has started believing in this Russian campaign. What do you think?
I think they've played very well the first two games, and... they don't look to be playing under any great pressure, to be honest. Surprisingly, obviously they are under great pressure, certainly ahead of the first game. But they look relaxed and composed, and the attacking midfielders who are good on the ball are showing that. And, you know, as you say, they've not got lucky, but they've had a couple of players like Cherchesov and Zuba who've come into the side. And it's just all clicked, hasn't it, at the last minute, incredibly.
As you say, incredibly, because there was no sign of this... of this clicking in any of the games leading up to the tournament. There was, you know, small defense of myself. I did mention in my preview that it was absolutely baffling to me that this midfield, which is potentially full of decent players, just could not seem to be able to play together before the World Cup. And now suddenly it's all fallen into place. And also, Cherchesov was getting a lot of stick for not picking Igor Denisov. Again, slightly mouthy defensive midfielder, gone with Gazinski from Krasnodar, for which he got a lot of criticism again, and it worked out very well because that midfield looks really, really balanced.
Sasha, you must now be beginning to think about who you want to face in the last 16, and a big question here, I'm guessing, is going to be goal difference now. You're 8-4-1 against, so it must be with trepidation that you eye up tomorrow's clash between Uruguay and Saudi Arabia.
I still think Russia would do very well to get anything out of the Uruguay game. Because I think we could see in the first game, Cavani and Suarez was a bit off colour, but those two can cause this Russian central defence a lot of problems. I mean, the Russians packed it today, but Cavani will be more of a threat than anything that Saudi Arabia offered, or indeed the half-fit Salah that we saw today.
Sasha, with the greatest respect, your predictions are worthless. Worthless.
Hold my hands up.
Duncan, have you got another stat about this incredible Russian side?
Well, just to kind of illustrate the fact that I guess you could say that everything is sort of going their way at the moment. I mean, they only have 3 shots on target in that game, obviously an own goal, and then they scored with 2 of their 3 shots on target. And similar story in the first game as well. So this is very much what happens in World Cups. It's such a short, you know, maximum 7 games. You need the luck. You need things to go in for you. And that seems to be what's happening for Russia so far. How long it lasts, you know, we'll wait and see.
Right. Because Uruguay don't look exactly irresistible. They're taking on Saudi Arabia tomorrow and will no doubt be looking to boost their goal difference there. Just the one goal in their opening game against Egypt. And Suarez in particular facing criticism for his for squandering chances, Michael.
Yeah, the first game he didn't look sharp enough, but I thought Cavani was excellent just behind him. Created 2 great chances for Suarez, had another long-range effort that was saved. Had a free
hit the post.
Hit the post from a free kick, I think. So I wouldn't be surprised if Uruguay win that comfortably, really. I don't think Suarez's struggles will continue. I think against that defence,
it'll be his 100th cap as well. So he'll he'll want to mark it with a goal or two.
Indeed, Duncan. Saudi Arabia, as you've no doubt read, coming into this game, a little bit shaken up. Their flight to Rostov featured one of their engines of the plane catching fire after being hit by a bird.
Yeah, they were saying that apparently somehow it didn't catch fire, even though there was a bird in the engine. But I'm not quite sure how
this engines
work.
This just in, the plane didn't catch fire.
Yeah. So they were claiming afterwards, even though there was footage of it catching fire. I don't know. I'm not sure how this works, to be honest.
I don't know either.
What could it have been? What looks like fire but isn't fire?
Quite a few things. Producer Ben's waving at me to move on. So just since we're on the subject of confusion, something that has been vexing a lot of people on social media, Michael, has been this notion that when you're celebrating a goal, and we saw this with Kieran Trippier, you can't have all the players off the field because a sneaky opponent would kick off and would be legally entitled to kick off if all your players were off the field and could therefore just sweep up field, a bit like Senegal did this afternoon against Poland. Is that true or not?
There's no sign of it in the laws of the game, so I'm quite perplexed about this because the footage does look as if there's a deliberate attempt to keep one man on the pitch.
Yeah, and it's not just England. Portugal did it as well.
Yeah, that one looked particularly blatant with the penultimate man gesturing for someone to stay on the pitch. I can only think that there's some kind of directive that involves something slightly more complex about excessive celebration or something, but there's nothing in the laws of the game, and it would be absolute carnage if that was allowed to happen.
The suggestion is that if all your players have left the field, the opposition can kick off.
But the laws of the game says every player must be in their own half of the pitch.
Right.
So what you really have to avoid doing is running to your own half and celebrating excessively, because then the opponent can kick off.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
So Tuesday's action then, seeing Russia continue their success at this World Cup with a 3-1 win over Egypt. Elsewhere in Group H, Senegal came up with an eventful 2-1 victory over Poland, and Japan were 2-1 winners over Colombia in Saransk. And let's move on now to that game, a game which was greeted with scenes like this in Tokyo. Japan, of course, have been beaten 4-1 by the Cafeteras last time they met in the World Cup. What a different story it was this time. I spoke to our friend Ben Maxwell from the J-Talk podcast at the final whistle.
I'm stunned, to be honest. Certainly wasn't expecting this. I don't think anybody who's a dedicated supporter of the Samurai Blue would have either, but they obviously got handed the perfect start, literally with Carlos Sanchez getting sent off in the third minute. And from there, I guess there was a little bit of frustration at the way the first half panned out, because it was a real opportunity, obviously, for Japan to ram home the advantage, and they didn't. And a very dodgy refereeing decision aside, and some dodgy keeping from Eiji Kawashima aside, they probably can't have too many complaints to have gone in level at the break, despite the gift they were given at the start. But yeah, good old Yuya Osako, hey, he's headed in, and I don't know. Well, you tell me. I think Japan have just stunned the world, haven't they?
Well, absolutely. And the way the other match has gone, there's every chance you could take control of this group.
To be completely honest, this was probably the one that Japanese supporters were dreading. Obviously, we have memories of Cuiabá in Brazil in 2014, the 4-1 loss in the last group stage game. And yeah, memories of, you know, we've been hammered with James Rodriguez highlights throughout the last few months of the European season, and everybody's been panicking about what Colombia were going to do to Japan. Well, Japan just turned them over, and it's definitely in Japan's hands. And it will definitely go to the last game anyway, if regardless of what happens against Senegal.
All right. Ben Maxwell from the J-Talk podcast. Japan, huh? Josh writing in to say, interesting to note that in the Japan game, Carlos Bacca was called by his number by Japanese commentators because the name Bacca is phonetically similar to the word moron.
Like Kevin Moran.
Yeah, I guess so. Who saw this one coming, Michael?
Well, I didn't. No, but I mean, it was massively influenced by that early incident, which led to a penalty and a red card, which you don't see that much anymore, because it has to be a kind of cynical, either a cynical foul or a deliberate handball to stop the ball going to the net. I actually thought Colombia played quite well. I mean, considering they're down to 10 men for 87 minutes, I thought their performance in the first half was excellent. They took the game to Japan. They were without James, who's their best player. Mm. They were without Carlos Sanchez, who got sent off. And then Peckerman made an interesting decision to take off Cuadrado and put on another holding midfielder to kind of stabilise the game. And I thought they did really well to get back into it at 1-1. Second half, they dropped much deeper and didn't attack so much. And I think that was actually the right strategy, because I think they would have been completely overrun playing 10 against 11 for the whole game. But I thought the centre-backs had a really, really poor game, both of them, but particularly Davinson Sanchez, who's had such a good season at Tottenham, but made the mistake for the first goal and just throughout was constantly getting turned by a couple of relatively average Japanese forwards.
So, yeah, he got turned for the first goal, which Kagawa shot was basically it was Carlos Sanchez, stuck his arm out, and then Kagawa put the penalty away, and Sanchez had been sent off. Quintero's free kick to equalise, a very clever one.
Yeah, it looked like it was something they definitely researched and planned for, because he hit it along the ground and the wall jumped up and it went under and went over the line, and the Japanese keeper protested. I mean, there was a bit of debate about whether he was protesting whether it should have been a free kick or not, or that it hadn't crossed the line, but the goal line technology clearly showed it had.
Right.
I have a problem with Kawashima's dive there, because I think he should have comfortably got there, yet he seems to have lost his goal line, basically, and I will put it down to goalkeeping mistake, actually.
I thought Radamel Falcao had an outstanding game, actually.
Okay.
I know, obviously, he finished on the losing side, but I think when you get a man sent off when you're playing that 4-2-3-1 formation, everyone goes to 4-4-1. What you basically need your forward to do is play a little bit as a number 9, a little bit as a number 10. And a lot of people have criticised Falcao for his kind of lack of all-round game. People said at the last World Cup that Colombia were better without him, but I just thought he was brilliant with his link play, his hold-up play, and more than anything, his ability to win free kicks. Several of which were definitely not free kicks, including the one for Quintero's goal. But, you know, it clearly meant a lot to him to play at the World Cup. And there was also that funny incident before the game where the referee seemed to misunderstand what Falcao wanted, having won the toss. Did you see this? Which obviously didn't cause too much of an issue, but I've never seen that happen before in football.
Basically, the teams had to swap sides.
Well, Falcao clearly won the toss.
Yeah.
And then the teams lined up as they were. And then just as they were about to kick off when the stadium did the countdown thing, Falcao suddenly waved in the referee's direction and said, actually, no, I wanted to switch.
I wonder if it was the sunshine, because the pitch was extremely illuminated on one half.
It was, and when you look at it, Ospina was then defending the shady side of the pitch, or the more shady side of the pitch. But that was peculiar. I can't work out whether he changed his mind or whether there was some communication breakdown, but it was very odd.
James Rodriguez did return to the side in the second half, so there's that. Colombia, with the way the results have gone, and with factoring in the Senegal-Poland game as well, it's still wide open, this group, isn't it?
It's really open. I mean, this was the most open group. I mean, all the sides had a chance of going through, and it's even more open now because you had two surprise results with Japan and Senegal winning, so all to play for. I think this is the most interesting group in the tournament.
And, of course, it's from this group that England, if England qualify, will take their next opponent, Duncan.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of little lines from this game are quite good. So going into the match, Colombia had played the most games at World Cups without ever having a red card. Obviously, that's now come to an end. And the team that have taken over from them is Japan.
That's quite nice.
And Japan, that was their fifth win at a World Cup, which means they've now won more than Scotland.
Just let that sink in for a second, Sasha. Sasha, what caught your eye about that Japanese win?
Princess Takamado in the stands. She becomes the first Japanese royal to visit Russia in 102 years.
Really?
Yep. Back in 1916, Japanese royals were visiting Russia to, you know, sign treaties and, you know, exchange arms, sell cruisers and stuff like that. So it's quite a historic moment.
Wow. Excellent. What do you make of, what do you make of Japan's chances against the other, for many people, surprise winners of Group H's Tuesday fixtures, Senegal, who were 2-1 winners over a woeful Poland?
Yeah, I must say I wasn't too surprised about this. I mean, to be honest, I was pleased with the result because in the preview show I'd said that I thought Senegal were good and Poland were rubbish, and I think that played out quite nicely. I don't think Senegal are a great side, but they're really compact, really well organised, good on the counter-attack. They've got some incredibly fast players. And Poland kind of just played a really simple, basic 4-4-2. I didn't think Milik and Lewandowski had any relationship whatsoever. And, yeah, I think Senegal are just quite exciting. I think the kind of side who, were they to progress and, you know, get a good side in the next round, England, quite possibly, then, you know, they could really play on the counter-attack and cause someone problems.
Yeah. Opening goal from where Drissa Gueye, well, actually it took a deflection off Colak and it was given as an own goal because, of course, Russians don't like to recognise Gueye goals. I think that's official justification. And then the second goal was even more controversial. Nyang. And the Poles were furious about this because Nyang had been off the field and wandered on just at the point when Krakowiak was inadvertently hoofing a ball back towards his own net, which then Nyang was able to run onto. But you know, are they right? Is there any justification for their complaints?
Not really. I mean, I do have some sympathy because it's quite an unusual situation, but I'm not sure what the referee... I'm not sure anyone can do there.
There was a moment of hesitation from Bednarik, the defender who came on, but I think in that situation, as a defender, you should just hoof the ball away.
I mean, Krakowiak shouldn't be hooking the ball back.
I mean, it was a terrible pass back anyway, whichever way you look at it. But just absolute mess, which I think sort of summed up Poland's performance. I think, just to add, Michael, to what you were saying earlier, I think basically... Poland just look like a team without a heart. There is no one to direct play in that side, and they just look really boring and poor, basically.
What do we make of this group now, then, Duncan, now that they've all had a game?
I think we can be pretty certain it's going to go down to the last set of games, which will be good, because I think a couple of the other groups will be dead rubber-tastic. So it'll be good to see. I don't know. I think any one of those four teams could still get through. I mean, Colombia played an entire match pretty much with 10 men. Then, you know, they're not going to do that again, you'd think. But, I mean, Senegal are unusual for an African team in that all their wins at World Cups have come against European teams. So, which, as Michael said a minute ago, if they do play England in the next round, is not good news for England.
Listeners, you know there's more to football than 52 years of hurt, penalty shootout heartbreak, and the inexplicable use of VAR. So, whilst we give you the game-by-game analysis at this World Cup, for a broader cultural and sociological view of the key narratives from Russia, you want to check out the new season of the Game of Our Lives podcast. With twice-weekly episodes throughout the World Cup, David Goldblatt and his co-host will be investigating issues like the politics of FIFA and the global industry of World Cup songs, and taking a deep dive into national footballing rivalries. If, like us, you were hooked by the excellent first season, you'll already know that host Goldblatt, one of the finest football journalists out there, has a unique curiosity and passion for the beautiful game. And if you didn't, you really should find out what you've been missing. Search for Game of Our Lives with David Goldblatt wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now.
Game of Our Lives. Sash, am I right in thinking that you're in one of the episodes of this new series?
I think I was in the first one.
And what were you talking about?
I was talking lots about Kaliningrad.
What a coincidence, because very shortly, Emma Saunders, a.k.a. the voice of Vicarage Road, will be telling us about that very subject. But what in particular about Kaliningrad?
Just its history. It's the cradle of Prussian civilization, if you like. And at the end of the Second World War, the Germans were expelled. The East Prussia was partitioned between Poland and Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And this is the reason why it is left as this cut-off exclave of the Russian Federation now. Of course, for many years, it was closed to the outsiders because it's the main base for the Baltic Fleet. It doesn't freeze. I saw the reports recently about... Russians moving rockets there and Poles getting upset about this. But, you know, in my understanding, this was always an area sort of bristling with missiles, if you like, because it is such a strategically important place for the Russian Federation. So I'm not really surprised. I mean, you could argue that it's an interesting time to start another build-up of weapons, given that everyone's looking and watching the World Cup. Maybe Russians are actually building up weapons somewhere else and they just want us to think that they're there.
Wow.
I was there in 2012, back when you couldn't do this sort of thing, as in I was traveling from Gdansk during the Euro 2012 via Kaliningrad and flying to Kiev. And what struck me, comparing it to Gdansk, was the how different things worked out. Because Gdansk was rebuilt after the war, whereas a lot of Königsberg, as it was called back then, was pulled down and dismantled. And this was actually a policy, because it was seen as the cradle of not just Prussian culture, but Prussian militarism, which led to the two world wars, which I think, and now I think the locals are sort of trying to sort of reconnect with that history. Some are for it, some are against it. In the early 90s, they used to get lots of German visitors, coming back, seeing effectively the homeland of the grandparents, causing extremely sad. But I think these days the area is also trying to sort of work itself maybe a new future as well, as some sort of free trade area. It's been like that for a few years, but I think they've been struggling to attract business. But there, I heard some talk about maybe making the area around the stadium, which is, by the way, built on the swamp. This whole thing you were hearing on television about it possibly sinking, it's not far from the truth.
Wait, I didn't hear that bit. So the stadium is sinking?
They built on the swamp. They used the wrong type of sand. So the subsidence is much greater than expected. There's a couple of guys in prison for this now, because basically they use cheaper sand, effectively. And so the whole project looks like a bit of a mess, but there is perhaps an idea of maybe turning the area around the stadium into some sort of like, you know, offshore financial zone. But I'm not sure how far those plans have gone. But in terms of football, East Prussia was never a hotbed of football. But Baltika Kaliningrad's ground is the oldest football ground in Russia.
Okay.
Because that's where Afaev Bear Königsberg used to play before 1945.
All right. Fantastic. As I say, Emma Saunders out there at the moment. Emma, who normally does stadium announcing for Watford, but is emceeing for the duration of the World Cup in Kaliningrad Stadium, as long as it's kind of stays above ground level. Producer Ben caught up with her a short time ago to find out how she's been getting on.
Yeah, so Dobre Ultra, as they say here, that means good morning. It's one of the many phrases I've picked up in the 8 or 9 days I've been here. I think it's safe to say I know enough now to get by. So the necessities, hello, thank you, goodbye, and beer. So it's going well. We've had one match so far in Kaliningrad Stadium, where I'm based as a presenter. It was Croatia against Nigeria. Not necessarily the glamour tie, but I think we're very much looking forward to the games that are coming in Kaliningrad Stadium. We've got Spain-Morocco on the horizon. Before that, Serbia-Switzerland. I think the Serbian fans are now slowly sort of filtering through. So a bit of an atmosphere here again. And then after, it's the big one, England-Belgium. So, yeah, it's been great and I think we've got lots to look forward to.
And Emma, has World Cup fever reached downtown Kaliningrad?
There's so many South American fans. Brazil aren't even playing here, but every time you go to the fan zone, it doesn't matter what time of day it is, who's playing, there's a Brazil flag and there's loads of people in there jumping up and down, making noise in their bright yellow and green, and they create the atmosphere here. And we spoke to the local guys and they think it's because, I'm not sure if they even need a visa at all, but they were explaining to us that to get into the country, it's a lot easier for them than it can be, well, for the likes of us. Our visa process was, should we say, involved at times. So there's a lot of South American football fans here, and particularly Brazil fans. But the fan zone itself, yeah, it's just what you imagine, really. A sea of colour people from all over the world, bringing along their football shirts, waving their flags. Like I said, regardless of the team that's playing. But I have to say, the first Russia game, that 5-0 thumping, full of local people, full of Russians, and we're heading back there again tonight. And I have to say as well, I've invested in a Russian shirt. Beautiful, bright red. The crest looks gorgeous on the Adidas. I love it. I love it, Ben.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable this.
Yes, yes, yes. Emma will be doing her thing on the mic Thursday at Kaliningrad Stadium for Serbia-Switzerland. Big game. Ooh. Now, thanks for all that info on Kaliningrad. Broadly speaking, though, Sasha, this has been pretty positive opening weekish to the World Cup. Having loads of reports of super friendly people in Volgograd picking up English fans at the airport, giving them oranges for the flight, all that kind of thing. What's been the mood like in Russia?
I mean, I think everyone's absolutely delighted about how well it's gone. I think on the pitch has been great. And off the pitch, the numbers of visitors have been absolutely fantastic. I mean, so you've had like 7,000 Swedes in Nizhny Novgorod. You have, I think, pretty much half of South America there as well, particularly the Peruvians taking over the place. And this was certainly a theme that carried on from last season, because the two sets of fans that made the Confederation Cup alive were the Chileans, and the Russians were quite upset they're not there, but the Peruvians replaced them in much greater numbers. But particularly, I think the guys who came back were in greater numbers with great expectations of fun are the Mexicans. There was a couple of thousand Mexicans at the Confederation Cup. They clearly went back home and told all their mates, this is a great place. So all the Mexicans turning up and turning, you know, game against Germany into home game. And the one set of fans that have been sort of missing are the English. Because the English weren't really in Moscow. I mean, you could argue about travel logistics and everything like that. But my Russian colleagues have been asking me, so where are they? Why haven't they come? Well, it's, you know, there's a lot of reasons. And I think one of the main ones is, you know, portrayal in the media, the aftermath of 2016, the scary hooligans, Putin's reputation, etc. But what you did get is various estimates. I mean, from 2,500 to 3,500 England fans turned up in Volgograd. Everything was speaking to people, everything was absolutely great. They occupied, there wasn't like a massive gathering somewhere in the city centre, but they certainly packed out all the pubs in the city centre. You know, what there was a pub where perhaps the guys didn't know, but they were actually drinking with the local hooligans who were, you know, made them feel like very welcome in a traditional sense, if you like. But also, I think what the Russians really appreciated was the way that the English visitors approached the history of the place, because of course, Battle of Stalingrad is a be possibly the most pivotal point in 20th century Russian or maybe Soviet history, perhaps of the 1917 revolution. And it holds great emotionally. It's a very important place for Russia as a nation. And the way that the English visitors, you know, went to, you know, the memorials, the way sort of they respected what was there. They respected the dead, the great sacrifice of the Russians. They, you know, also I really actually enjoyed. It was a wonderful story that Barney Roney published in The Guardian about his grandfather, who was captured by the Russians here, and he was wounded, and the Russians actually put him in a field hospital, you know, made him better, and after the war he returned back home. And I think this whole the positivity, I think, is possibly even more important as a takeaway from the first week than the performance on the pitch, because the Russians here, they showed a face to the world that perhaps we don't really see it very often, because we don't get the tens of thousands of people going to all these towns, and they don't really get to experience the genuine Russia, which is a place of great hospitality, which is something I talked about beforehand. I think a lot of thinking in this country is still perhaps dominated by Rocky IV and the Cold War.
It's not just Drago.
It's not just Drago, exactly. It's the Russians are not just Drago. And may it carry on, because I think it's been very heartwarming so far.
Sun, sea, sand and football. Watching the World Cup on holiday sounds like paradise, until you try watching a game online and realise seconds before kickoff that it's blocked. Well, instead of bemoaning your decision to book a trip during a tournament that comes around once every 4 years, you need to get yourself a virtual private network from bestvpn.com, and you'll be able to access the internet freely wherever you are this summer, all for less than the price of a pint. Because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can get 70% off a VPN by visiting bestvpn.com/podcast. BestVPN.com will set you up with a VPN in minutes so you can watch the football from your deck chair or by the pool. And when it comes to security, BestVPN.com will also protect your internet activity from prying eyes on open Wi-Fi networks. No matter where you are in the world, you can access your online home comforts with a VPN. So unlock the internet today with BestVPN.com. Find out more and get 70% off by heading to BestVPN.com/podcast.
We've seen every team play at least once. At least some of the matches we've seen. A, Duncan, what's been the most impressive team? I'm going to throw some quickfire questions at you. Most impressive team?
England.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to pull out the old expected goals metric here, which I know you adore. But I think, you know, they had 2.85, which is more than any other team. They had basically more in the first half against Tunisia than every team other than Brazil did in an entire game. And, you know, they were really good. I mean, there was a couple of spells in the game where it kind of went a bit awry. But, you know, given what we know about England in tournaments, they did well.
Okay. Michael?
I really liked Mexico. I think, you know, to be an underdog and play with such bravery, really, and courage against the reigning world champions was exceptional. And on the subject of expected goals, I thought that was one game where it didn't show up, because they had so many kind of three-on-ones they didn't convert into shots, if that makes sense, that I think that would kind of underestimate how good their performance was.
Sasha, most impressive team?
I could say Russia, but I would also say Peru. I thought Peru played with fantastic heart and skill against Denmark. I think they were very unfortunate to lose that game, but I think they would cause trouble for France.
Most impressive individual performance, Sasha?
Cheryshev over the two games for Russia.
Really? Okay. Michael?
I'd go for Ronaldo, not just for his goals, but I thought his all-round game was fantastic.
Hard to argue with that, wouldn't you say, Duncan?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, as we talked about before, Ronaldo coming into this tournament had it all to prove, and what a way to do it.
Absolutely. What about best goal then? What's been the best goal so far, Duncan?
I mean, I really love that Quintero goal today. I just, you know,
the free kick under the wall.
Yeah, just under the wall. It looks brilliant. I mean, it's just made for a montage. Imagine how many times that's going to be in a montage at the end of the tournament.
Sasha, you look at your notes. I'll go to Michael.
Yeah. I would go for both Nacho and Coutinho, because I think they showed lovely swerve in different ways. And I think one of the great positives about this tournament has been the ball. You know, previous tournaments have been affected by the ball just flying all over the place, and this one moves a lot in the air, but always in the way that it should do. It's not random late swerves. It allows skill and finesse, and I think it's been one of the best things about the tournament.
Well, just to back up Michael's point, I mean, we all remember the ball in 2010 was not a revered ball. At this stage of the tournament then, two goals from outside the box. It's been seven now.
Seven this time, right.
Wow.
Okay. Of course, the biggest contributor to goals this year has been own goals, which are well on target to take the golden boot, no?
Yeah, the record is 6 in 1998, and we're already on 5 after day 6 of the tournament. So, yeah, own goals are having a great old time.
Okay. Sasha?
Favourite goals, Kolarov, free kick, and Mertens against Panama.
Oh, yeah, that was good, wasn't it?
There have been some great goals.
But Nacho's goal was the best goal. I don't know what you're all thinking about. I mean, it was. It sounded like this. Portugal vai ser os mata de Nacho. Gol da Espanha. Marca Nacho. Good times. Biggest disappointment, Michael. Not you, I'm not just asking.
Thank you. I think just that Colombia red card today.
I
think it just
killed that game.
Kind of. I mean, actually, it was still an entertaining game, but I felt bad for Colombia because I thought they could have been very exciting.
Really? Duncan, biggest disappointment for you so far?
The efficiency of VAR, possibly. Yeah. Just killing the game with sterilisation. Argentine coaches, I don't think any of them...
I kind of vowed we wouldn't talk about VAR, but it's funny because that efficiency, and they've sorted the time thing out, and it's enabling them to kind of peddle this narrative whereby VAR's working, but it really isn't. And I think anyone who watched the England game can't believe that VAR is working, because it really isn't. And even if it was, that's not the point of football. But let's move on. Sasha?
Disappointment Nigeria. Utterly incompetent.
Right.
Just totally. I don't know what football they were playing at against Croatia. It's just really bad.
Okay. Best stat, Duncan. What's been the best stat so far?
Got a few. There's one today. Shinji Kagawa, first player who's got a part of the lower body in his name, scored a penalty at World Cup since Oleg Salenko. Like that one. And just kind of reiterating England's kind of dominance on Monday night, Harry Maguire has had as many touches in the opposition penalty area so far as Neymar.
Neymar, by the way, who hobbled out of training. He obviously got a bit of a clattering in Brazil's...
Switzerland conceded 19 fouls and 10 of them were on Neymar.
Really? So he went out of training. Of course, that's a bit of a worry. And they're playing on Friday against Costa Rica. Okay. For all of that, Wednesday has some interesting games. What are they? These. One o'clock, it's Group B action that kicks things off as Portugal take on Morocco at the
Stadion Luzhniki.
Then we're back to Group A as Uruguay take on Saudi Arabia down south at the
Arena Rostov.
And then we're back to Group B for Iran-Spain. That's way out east in
Arena Kazan.
Very nice. Excellent. Ooh, let's talk about these games. What do you fancy talking about first? We kind of did Uruguay-Saudi Arabia way back at the start of the show, so let's put that one to one side. And we'll talk about that Iran game and some of the socio-political implications of Iranian success at this World Cup a little bit later on. Let's begin, though, with Portugal's clash with Morocco. Portugal, who've given us, as I mentioned before, one of the moments of the tournament so far.
Ronaldo through the wall! Cristiano Ronaldo!
Ronaldo's free kick for the hat-trick to earn a point against the Spanish. A performance that, from CR7, so good that they finally changed that bust at Madeira Airport. Have expectations in Portugal changed following that game? Or here is Carlos Santos from Smart Odds.
Everyone's expecting a much better Portugal in the second game. Because right now, after what happened against Spain, it's higher. Because I remember speaking to you and telling you that, look, I'm not expecting a lot of Portugal in the first game. And let's be honest, their defensive performance wasn't the best. But just the fact that Ronaldo performed the way he did, I mean, everyone is expecting for much more national team now, because if you had already some confidence in it and your best player just put a performance like that, then you're in for a treat. Morocco isn't Spain. You're expecting Portugal to be a bit more aggressive on the ball. So I'm pretty sure that we're going to have André Silva next to Ronaldo. I'm pretty sure that Portugal will have more possession than Morocco. And I wouldn't be surprised to see a couple of defensive changes. Ricardo Pereira, who just signed for Leicester, coming on for Cedric. And even Bruno Alves coming on for Jose Fonte. So those are the changes people are talking about. And they have some logic. They have some logic.
Interesting that about the defensive changes, because that was what I think the big question mark about their performance against Spain, wasn't it? The Fonte and Pep at the back.
Yes, that is true. And I don't think they'll be happy with the goal that Diego Costa scored. He kind of outwitted both of them and scored a very fine goal. I'm quite looking forward to this game. I think Morocco started their opener against Iran very brightly, couldn't really sustain the tempo, but I think maybe showed more attacking invention than I expected, because, you know, I mentioned their good defensive record. I think obviously the key player is Ronaldo. He's probably going to be up against Mehdi Benatia, which is a contest we've seen a couple of times in the Champions League, generally with Ronaldo coming out on top. So I think this could be a lively game, probably the most exciting game of the day.
We had a go at Sasha earlier on for his predictions about Russia. You, on the other hand, Michael, called Morocco the most underrated team in this World Cup.
Yeah, I thought they played really good football in the first half against Iran, but they didn't get the goal. And
well, they did, but it was at the wrong end.
They did, yeah, in the wrong end. So they probably need to get, well, they definitely need to get a result from this. They probably need to win it because they'll be up against Spain in the final game. But I do think that first game against Iran has probably, well, significantly dented their chances of going through from a very tough group.
All right, they'll be without Nuruddin Amrabat here, who's got concussion after being slapped repeatedly by their medical team. So
I'm quite interested in one of the fans at this particular match. Once Sepp Blatter arrived in Moscow today, and I understand Vladimir Putin invited him to come to the match tomorrow.
Oh, really?
As well as Brazil, Costa Rica.
Is he returning some kind of favour or something?
I don't know. Is he wearing a fake moustache? I don't know, but he should be there.
That Ronaldo performance, though, against Spain, can he reproduce that now against Morocco? Do you think, Duncan?
I think he probably can, yeah. I mean, he'd scored 3 goals from 70 shots before this World Cup, and he scored 3 goals from 4 shots in this World Cup. So he seems
Is this going to be his tournament?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think it could be. I mean, obviously, he's now got presumably 2 games in the group stages where he can add at least a few more goals. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing, think back to, I mean, these two teams were both in England's group in 1986, and Morocco actually beat Portugal. It was their first ever win at a World Cup. So there's a bit of history there. I think that's their only meeting they've ever had. So
I believe it is.
Yeah.
Well, the other game from Group B taking place on Wednesday is a very interesting one. Iran, who are actually on top of the group right now, taking on the pre-tournament favourite, Spain. Fascinating clash, as I say. Team Melli's World Cup efforts, though, not the only important campaign going on right now in the Persian game. Shireen Ahmed is an Iranian sports writer and activist based in Toronto. An earlier producer, Ben, spoke to her about weather Iran could do the business against Spain and other matters off-field.
Spain is a powerhouse, and the way that they maneuver, a lot of those players play together internationally as well in terms of their clubs, which is not always the case with Team Iran. I mean, you have a couple that play in Persepolis in the Iranian league, but not out. Now, there's challenges that they face as a team that is different than Spain. Like, for example, Nike football decided not to give them boots 2 weeks before the World Cup started, so because of sanctions. And I think there's different challenges that the team faces, but it's not an insurmountable feat to beat Spain, but they'll just have to tactically change a lot. Spain is very, very confident and come out aggressively. Spain also waits till the second half, in my opinion, to really go at blows. So it's going to be a very tough 90 minutes for Iran. Do I think it's possible? Yes, because I think anything is possible, as we've seen with Mexico beating the defending World Cup champions. So a lot of it is passion. And, you know, the football gods have a mind of their own.
Just how big a sport is football in Iran, Shireen? I mean, are these guys in the national team on the brink of Salah-like levels of stardom and national symbolism?
Well, I wish I could say that that was the case. And we don't hear the name of them being household names. And that's just because, like, none are playing in a high level, high profile. I mean, Mohamed Salah has done incredible things at Liverpool and has really made his own name, and not just because of the LFC chants, but has made also Islam quite famous. He does prostrations, he supplicates before he goes on, and these things are interesting and important. There are also things that Team Iran does as well, and always have. Now, what it is that no specific player comes to mind, really. But as a team and as a whole, the only way that the team has been amplified has been the way that people have commented on how good looking they are. Now, that doesn't speak to their football prowess, but I mean, they get attention in that, right? And football is a way of life in Iran. It lives and breathes. The people of Iran Persian people love football so much that, you know, they follow, they're excited. Now, Persian folks all over the world are watching, and I saw a video clip of Iranian community in Los Angeles and how they completely were overjoyed. Like, we see that joy mirrored all over the world. And Iran is no exception. The Tehran Derby is one of the biggest events in Iran. They have their own league. They have stadiums that are full all the time. They have, you know, and that leads us to another conversation about who accesses those stadiums. But I think that it's normal to say, just because we don't see about it in our day-to-day lives doesn't mean that passion doesn't exist there.
And you've just touched on it there, Shireen. The TV cameras picked up a small group of women protesting in the stands during the Morocco game. Tell us what the situation is as regards female fans going to football games back home.
Yeah, this is one of the really beautiful ways that football can amplify campaigns and human rights issues in the world. And we saw Iranian women. Now, just to be clear, this isn't the first time that Iranian women have attended matches at the World Cup. They were in Brazil. They were in South Africa. And the reason for that is that they are not permitted to attend any sporting events, not just football, any sporting events in public places or stadiums in Iran. Now, this ban was enacted in 1979. And there have been people campaigning for over a decade about the injustice of it. Now, the reasoning behind it is that it's sort of twofold, and it's interpreted differently. It could be interpreted that women, you know, it would be breaking the quote unquote moral code, or they would be exposed to some type of vulgarity. But I mean, that's not on the shoulders of those women who simply just want to love football. And I think the important thing here is to remember that these grassroots movements that have been existing are not in a vacuum. They're a culmination of things, and women have the strength, and Iranian women are some of the most resilient and incredible, and they do the work. They have been working and campaigning, everything from change.org positions to having conversations with higher level executives. I mean, Sepp Blatter in 2013 was quoted as saying he was trying to lobby Iranian government to try to allow it, but it's lip service. In fact, Infantino was actually at the Tehran Derby when 35 Iranian women and girls, the youngest being as young as 13, were detained for trying to dress up as boys to enter the stadium. So this is something else that these women do, is they try to dress up as boys simply to access a sport they love, and it's so heartbreakingly unfair.
That was very interesting there from Shireen Ahmed. You can read more from her at shireenahmed.com. And you can also hear her on the Burn It All Down podcast. On the pitch then, Iran taking on Spain, could they? It's been a World Cup of shocks. Could they?
I mean, I'd be surprised. They might be able to frustrate Spain. I mean, I think there's a very good chance that by the end of this tournament, this will be the largest possession share that one team has, because obviously, Spain is Spain, and Iran are naturally very defensive, and having got the win in the first game, would be delighted with a 0-0 here.
Hilarious thing that Carlos Queiroz said today. I mean, he said obviously Iran played to win, and that they will try to control the ball as much as possible.
That's nice.
But there is a problem for Iran as well. Lost Chashimi, one of the centre-backs, to a muscle injury, so he's out for the rest of the tournament.
Big game for Sadar Azmoun, known as the Iranian Messi, etc. and so on, because he actually plays for Rubin Kazan, who of course used this stadium.
Home ground for him.
Indeed.
Can I just say as well that on Iran, football journalists often complain about getting like really bad abuse on social media and stuff. But of all the teams I've ever written about, Iranian fans have been the most pleasant and the most friendly and the most polite. I wrote an article about them ahead of the last World Cup that basically said they might not be that rubbish. And I just got floods of messages saying, thank you so much for taking the time to research about them. So I got quite into following them in that tournament. I'm going to watch this game tomorrow with a couple of Iranian friends, picked up from social media, just happened to be in Iranian friends in an Iranian restaurant in West London. So I'm genuinely
looking forward to it. Which one are you going to, Michael?
I don't know the name of the restaurant. Sorry, one of them says it's the best Iranian restaurant in town. So I'll take his word for it.
It's funny because most Iranians in London seem to live their life as a perpetual quest to find the best Iranian restaurant. And every month it changes.
I'll report back.
But yeah, no, do, because love a bit of Persian food.
Persian food's great, isn't it?
Yeah. Fantastic. Of course, if you were following them in the 2014 World Cup, you'll recall how close they came to holding the eventual finalist Argentina to a goalless draw.
Yeah, until that late Messi moment. Mm. So they've got all his kind of Barcelona teammates to contain this time.
And I bet no one gave them any chance ahead of that game either.
No, they didn't. But I mean, Carlos Queiroz has an incredible record in terms of defensive organisation. I mean, he was the brainchild really behind Manchester United's great success during kind of mid to late 2000s. He's one of the best defensive organisers, one of the best defensive coaches around. So he has got them really well drilled. And I mean, if Spain score early, it could be an exhibition game. But if it gets to 25, 30 minutes, and I wouldn't be surprised if Iran frustrated them. But obviously, yeah, I expect Spain will prevail eventually.
Iran's last three goals at World Cups have come in the last 15 minutes. So, if they can hang on, which is a big ask, but if they can, yeah, possible.
All right. Both teams, of course, having to overcome huge difficulties in the run-up to their opening games. Iran had to find some shoes somewhere. And Spain, of course, had to find a manager. But they didn't seem too bothered about that. I mean, everything just seemed to roll on more or less. If it hadn't been for that pesky Ronaldo, they'd have been celebrating a fat 3 points, because they look very impressive, didn't they, in that Iberian derby?
Is there an argument he might have over-fiddled with the subs a little bit?
Do you think?
Maybe. That's just a mild sort of criticism of Hierro.
Mm. Okay. Costa looked good. Spain looked good, basically. Even if they didn't win, they looked good.
I think the best team so far.
That Costa goal was really good. I mean, it wasn't even the second best goal of the game, but to outwit both the defenders and show your strength and provide a really good finish, I thought it was just outstanding.
To elbow Pep in the throat and get away with it, well done.
Some of their battles over the years in the Madrid derbies were just, I mean, disgusting, but quite brilliant to watch. They're just complete bastards, both of them.
Nicely put. All right. Well, that's our thoughts on Wednesday's action, but what are the odds on those games? Of course, Paddy Power here to tell us, speaking to producer Ben.
Thank you, Jimbo. I've got Lee Price on the line. Lee, we're looking ahead to Wednesday's games now. It's the return of Portugal and the return of Morocco. Ronaldo got a hat-trick in the first game. Are hopes high that he might do the same thing again here?
Yeah, so Ronaldo to score a hat-trick again in this game is just 20-1. Usually we're looking at around 50-1 for a player scoring the treble, but they've been slashed in after the first game antics. Your boys, Morocco, your tip pre-tournament, need a result here. They're 5-1 to get the win. Portugal 8-13, and the draw is 13-5.
Let's stick in Group B then. The evening game is Iran versus Spain. Iran are top of the group. Can they stay there?
I don't think so. I mean, I know David De Gea's thrown them in, but this one, odds-wise, is a foregone conclusion. Iran are 18-1 to get consecutive victories and pretty much secure a place in the next round. Spain are 1-7. Massive favourites for this. 13-2 for the draw might be interesting.
And the game at 4 o'clock is Uruguay versus the mighty Saudi Arabia. Could Uruguay score more than five here? They weren't too impressive in their opening game.
They weren't too impressive, but Saudi Arabia even less impressive. Uruguay really can score more than five goals, and they really should. This could get double figures, to be honest with you. Uruguay are just 1-7 to win, which is short. Bear in mind, that's the same price as Spain to beat Iran. Saudi Arabia 19-1 to win this fixture. Uruguay 7-1 to draw. To score more than five goals, you get as low as 3-1, which is very short.
You can find out those odds and more at paddypower.com. It is 18 plus only, begambleaware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. You can tweet us at The Totally Show on Twitter with your questions and that kind of thing. Also, we're on Facebook, where we've got all sorts of videos, quizzes, competitions, and more. Most importantly, though, we have another podcast coming up for you straight after the final whistle on Wednesday night. So hopefully you'll be joining us for that, possibly on Thursday morning, if that's more convenient for you, listener. Meantime, many thanks for being with us this evening, Sasha Gurionov.
Pleasure.
Duncan Alexander.
Thank you, James.
Followable at Ollie Sailor.
Oily Sailor.
For all your stat needs. And Michael Cox at Zonal
underscore marking.
Right.
Still haven't got that one back.
No, sadly not.
Sasha, you're grrr.
Slasher, four R's.
Slasher with four R's. That's a lot of R's.
Grrr.
All right, listener. See you tomorrow. Bye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. Subscribe now and get the latest episode delivered right to your phone for free. Supporting your team at the World Cup can be a phenomenal experience.
But then Beckham boots Simeone, Lampard's goal isn't given, or someone puts on an England shirt and misses a penalty. The highs, more often than not, come with lows. And that's a little bit like life, really. So while we're all supposed to be buzzing with World Cup excitement and lapping up all this football, all that VAR and all those Nigeria kits, remember that someone close to you might be going through one of life's tougher times. Every day, on average, 12 men take their own life in the UK. That's your starting 11 and your manager every single day. Scary, huh? But that's part of the problem. Many of us still feel mental health and suicide are taboo topics, and this can stop men from opening up and getting support when they need it most. That's why we're working with Calm, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide. We here at the Totally Football Show believe we should all support each other the way we support our team, through the ups and the downs, the glorious wins and the embarrassing red cards, the good days and the bad. So if you're worried that someone close to you is having a tough time, check in with them and let them know that Calm is there. Every day from 5 p.m. till midnight, Calm provides a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. They've also got a website which is packed with the kind of info you need if you or any of your mates are having a rough one. Visit thecalmzone.net to find out more about Calm.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Tired of losing weight only to gain it all back? The weight loss experts at SlimRank.com have done the research. SlimRank.com ranks the safest, most effective GLP-1 programs that get and keep the weight off for good. Stop watching the scale go up and down. Go to SlimRank.com and pick America's number one weight loss program today. SlimRank.com. That's SlimRank.com. Your dream body is just a few months away. SlimRank.com.